Let me go to you, Justin, if you don't mind. I've already mentioned the changes to that were announced in 2017, the abolition of the 457 visa. How big were those changes from your perspective and from the perspective of the people you're working with?
Very significant changes. And I suppose for businesses and for our clients, predictability is really important. Being able to plan their global mobility and their workforce is critical. And so the changes, and as you pointed out, there was very limited consultation before they were announced, which suggested quite a political aspect. But look, the changes resulted in a complete change in approach in terms of the occupation lists. So the eligible occupations to be able to utilise one of the temporary skilled visa programs. So it was split into three lists, a short-term list, a medium and long-term list, and a regional list. And so the changes meant that if the occupation was deemed on the medium long-term list, it was pretty much sort of status quo in terms of the ability to move to PR and an ability to get a visa of a substantive length of time. But if the occupation was on the short-term list, there were some major impacts to business. And that meant it was a maximum of 2 years. There was an ability to extend once onshore, so a maximum of 4 years in total. But most importantly, it excluded the ability to move to permanent residency. And that was one of the big impacts on business, is the ability to attract someone to fill a position where there isn't an ability to stay really had an impact on business. So those were in terms of the occupation lists. Some of the other changes was that it got a lot more expensive. So the introduction of the Skill in Australians levy. So that's a levy per applicant or per visa holder per year. So it's come at a very much increased cost to business, and that was sort of on top of increases to the visa application charges as well. I guess the third one is changes to make it mandatory for labour market testing. So this concept of Australians first. So you can only utilise these programs if you've tested the Australian market, which meant that there was these there is prescriptive rules on how to advertise positions, and they're very prescriptive, and it's very easy for businesses to have small errors in terms of how they've framed their advertisement, in terms of mistakes, the consequences are quite severe in terms of the delegates of the department having to refuse applications, which then has a very significant financial impact on business. So I guess those are the three sort of main ones in terms of the change in occupation lists into three separate lists, which dictate what you're entitled to, the cost, and the fact that it's now mandatory for labour market testing unless there's exempt under one of the free trade agreement exemptions.
So let me just follow up on two things. Labour market testing is something we got asked a bit about. I think it's really interesting because the OECD doesn't think it works, essentially, or thinks there's better ways to do things. The unions actually don't think it works. It's not tough enough. And business doesn't think it works either. And kind of anecdotally, I mean, I'm looking around the room thinking, how many of you figure you've been seen or been part of an interview process where you kind of know who they want to appoint, but everyone's going through the motions? Is it like that? Yeah, I mean, is it... know who you want to get, but you got to go through the motions.
Look, it's interesting. I think one of the things that is happening is there's a change in the way companies are recruiting. The days where people sort of opened the newspaper to find a job are sort of gone. There's really different ways in which people are recruiting. So the way the labour market testing policies have been developed is a little bit old-fashioned, and I guess you know in terms of the temporary skilled migration program, you're only eligible to utilise the program if the occupation has already been analysed and deemed in shortage in Australia. So there has been that analysis already, and that's why the occupation is available for the temporary skilled visa program. So having to advertise again does seem to be a little bit of unnecessary red tape at times, and you know there are certain, as you pointed out with some examples in your presentation, that the skills required are very niche, very specific, and therefore having to go through the process of labour market testing when you know there are only a few individuals that can do the role and are out there in the market because you understand your market. It can be a process of ticking boxes, an unnecessary red tape for business.
And I think that's what when we look at our recommendations, we sort of argued that if you improve the process of identifying those skills shortages and the occupations that go on the list, and you improve it in a way where people can see the data, they know the data's been, properly analysed, that should build confidence. And it sort of then negates the need to have labour market testing. So we're trying to say we get the concern about it, but, why introduce an inefficient, ineffective layer of bureaucracy to actually respond to something that you've already responded to? And perhaps a bit more transparency around that would sort of allow that to occur. I'll come back to you on the permanent piece, if that's all right.
Sure.
Kian, technology stands out, and you look at the occupations, you look at the jobs that people are doing, and I think the big structural shifts coming through the economy. I think it's one area where people do probably accept or expect that we are going to need some skills from overseas, and it's certainly an area where I think you look at Cochlear and technology and new ideas and how they've built that. How important is temporary skilled migration to your business, and how do you think about managing your workforce around it?
Look, I mean, it's critical. I mean, it's the lifeblood of our business at the moment. I mean, we have a very traditional part of our business which still provides a large central computing, which we can absolutely provide resources from Australia. No problems with that at all. But we have a bleeding edge bit of our business which is ultimately looking at the digital agenda. We're doing a lot of ideation. We're looking at conceptual views of what business problems can be in the future. And ultimately, we're dealing with technology that is only just being evolved. We've got an example at the moment where we have a Microsoft practice where we have Microsoft Dynamics 365 people. Now, we know we own 80% of the market. People who do that at the level we need them to do, 80% of them work for us. And we know it by name, everybody who doesn't work for us, and we know what they do. And we know for absolutely that we've tapped the market. But we have exponential growth here. The market is desperate for it. And every time we have to go offshore, there is obviously the example where we have to then go and advertise for 28 days. We have to do a whole bunch of things. But we can name everybody in the market who does this today. And we can also name pretty much everybody who does it in India, everybody who does it in the UK, and everybody who does it in the US, because the technology is so niche and so evolving at such a rapid rate. And that's across a number of sectors within our business. So I think, for us, projects, the way in which we procure and the way our clients procure now, can often be the case of needing someone within 2 to 3 or 4 days, because we work in an agile framework now, where we work in sprints. And, a delay of a week can often be a massive delay to a project. And we've got a lot of resources on the ground. We've got commitments to the client. And we've already started to see that that's actually significantly impacting projects longer term for our clients too. So, absolutely, it is critical.
Mm. Now, audience, I'm putting you on notice. I'm going to ask two more questions, and then it's over to you. So warm your questions up, if you don't mind. Peter, you're in an interesting kind of situation because obviously, it's getting skills into the economy, really important to business, but you're working within the government, in the face of all these changes, how do you manage that, and what do you think from the perspective of employment and, I mean, making sure the jobs are here for Australians, but also helping businesses that need to access those skills? How do you juggle those things, and how are you seeing the policy at the frame, the way it's framed at the moment?
Well, the juggling aspect is obviously tricky. So from where the portfolio I work for sits, clearly a key focus of ours is getting Australians into the labour market. Mm. We have responsibility for job active and getting unemployed Australians into the labour market. But of course, to do that, you need businesses to be functioning, businesses to be successful, and skilled migration is a part of that. I think it's trying to find the balance. I think in your presentation, you spoke about a lot of the competing tensions there, and I think we accept skilled migration will always be a part for the reasons that you outlined, but it's finding the balance to make sure that the skilled migration is there for where it's needed and not displacing local workers, and for those other elements that where we are capable of, we either have existing people in the labour market, or whether we're capable of quickly developing those skills. That's what we should be focused on, but it is obviously a range of competing tensions across government as well.
So let me ask you a question about one example, and it sort of plays into this regional skills need as well. You know, one of the areas where we've seen regional agreements struck is around meat processing. And that's been for a couple of years at least. And that's also an area where I think people in the community might say, well, how come we can't grow those skills? What do you think the issue is there in terms of, yes, it is a regional location. Maybe there's an issue about people not wanting to locate there. There's definitely people from overseas who find it a very attractive proposition. But how do you think if I was sitting in the community going, well, isn't that an area? Yes, it's a skill, but that's something you think a properly functioning education system should be able to be responsive to that. What do you think needs to change to sort of improve that? Or is that just one of those things that's going to continue on as well, that it's just going to be an ongoing skill need?
Well, clearly, I think it's one of those areas, as you say, in regional areas, particularly around regional areas where there is significant unemployment. And while some of them are skilled jobs, they're not necessarily at the higher end of the skills that we would see. And certainly, again, from our portfolio's perspective, we would prefer to see the local workforce there. But clearly, there are issues for those employers in getting enough people into the jobs. I think there are some drivers in that, certainly in terms of some of our consultations and discussions. One of the issues is obviously in meat processing and other areas with the range of equipment and so on, there's quite stringent drug and alcohol policies.
Yeah.
And they have had, our understanding anecdotally, is difficulty with finding people who can meet those criteria. And I think also getting the levers right in terms of encouraging people to do those jobs. Often it's the jobs that are not seen as the most desirable are also the ones where you see the biggest trouble for employers in trying to find local workforces.
I raise it as a bit of an example. Number one, the community, as I understand it, the regional community is really supportive of it because it's very important to the local economy. But I sort of put it out there too because I think as we think about the future demands for workforce, there are going to be some sectors where some jobs will be within those sectors will be highly skilled, and some will be a little bit further down. And I'm thinking particularly about things like aged care and disability care. And so I think this is, as we think about the big conversations around this program in the future, that's going to be one of the areas. And that, to me, there's some of these regional examples are, in a way, almost a bit of a leading indicator of some of the broader conversations that we are going to have to be having in the future about how this scheme works.
Oh, look, I think it's clearly a factor and a factor in some of how regional areas survive and prosper. I know there's a couple of examples of sort of small towns in Victoria and elsewhere who have targeted particular ethnic communities overseas to bring them in. And that's meant that the towns that have been declining have suddenly seen a population growth that keeps schools open, it keeps businesses open.
They're also a good case study in all the different elements that you have to get right.
Yes.
You know, jobs, schools, community cohesion, community support, housing, et cetera, et cetera. So let's just quickly turn to education. It's interesting when you look at the data. I mean, obviously people know about the rapid growth in students coming on temporary visas, clearly important to the university sector, but also being able to attract the sorts of lecturers and expertise in courses that themselves are going to be critical to being attractive to foreign students. So how is the UTS thinking about the system? How engaged in the policy formulation does the university get?
Universities tend to work through our peak body, through Universities Australia. You can imagine our shock when university lecturers weren't on the middle to long-term skills list when 40% of our staff across the university sector is born is overseas. They're not Australians. So the universities did lobby very strongly and got that changed quite quickly. It's a significant expense for the university sector as well, because every time one of those staff stays here for now, new staff stays for a year, it's another $1,800 on top.
Yeah.
Just builds and builds. It's quite. But the issue that complicates it for the education sector is, of course, the fact that part of the attraction for the export industry of international students, which is worth $30, $35 billion a year, is the opportunities to work and migrate going forwards. And I think the interesting microcosm that exemplifies the tensions here is accounting. The reaction from the education sector at the suggestion that we have enough accountants and that it should be taken off the medium long-term list. But of course that would mean there'd be thousands and thousands of fee-paying students who wouldn't come to the universities or to the private providers to do. So what I'm saying is that the settings tend not to be pure. It's not purely set from an employment workforce enhancement thing. There are other factors which come in which distort things. And the problem any government has is to try to explain the nuances and subtleties and the different factors that affect the settings they're putting in place. And it is almost too complex to explain to your reader of the Daily Telegraph or who listens to Alan Jones. And then the other side of it is we design wonderful systems with wonderful requirements and settings, and then we spend no money at all on implementing them. So immigration is continuously underfunded in its capacity to manage its compliance work, its checking on, we put this great system in place and then we don't give our government departments enough money to make it work properly. And then when it falls over, we blame the system rather than the fact that we just haven't invested in making it work.
All right. Jagar, you've got the mic going, got the green sign. Questions? If you wouldn't mind just saying who you are and where you're from, that helps us.
My name is Virginia Wong from Commonwealth Treasury. Thank you, panel. I just have a quick question in regards to the changes in 2017 with the TSS visas. There's a comment on the permanent residency part. My question is, do you think it was the lack of, I guess, access to permanent residency that's made it, I suppose, perhaps less attractive? Or is it that the short-term visa is too short for business purposes? I guess if the short-term visa was, for example, 8 years, would that kind of resolve kind of the business side of things, or is it just the lack of permanent residency?
We're looking at you.
Yeah. look, it depends on individual circumstances, and one of the things I've kind of noticed is that this concept of people chasing permanent residency, again, is perhaps a little bit old-fashioned now. I think, in the current, international market of skills, people chase opportunities. And while some people want to migrate to Australia, look, others may not. And so, I guess it depends on circumstances. And sometimes people perhaps intend to come for a couple of years to take that opportunity, but meet the love of their life, perhaps, and then sort of want to stay for other reasons, or love the environment or other reasons. But in terms of the corporate perspective, if a person's a highly skilled engineer from Germany with a family and are given the opportunity opportunity to come to Australia to work on a new project. Uprooting the family and taking them to Australia with a maximum of 4 years and the disruption to that person's life, it could be that determinant of the person sort of saying no. And I think that's what we've seen in terms of the difficulty for corporates, mm-hmm. Where the occupation's only on the short-term list, for it to be attractive enough for the person to take up that opportunity. And sometimes these are really highly skilled people, yeah. that Australia needs. So, just that policy line that it's no one on that... on the short-term list can move to PR, I think
I agree entirely, Justin. I think, and maybe it's just optionality, but let's just put a couple of other... I think the point about family is absolutely important, because a lot of the people you're going to be bringing in have family considerations of one version or another. I think the other thing that people possibly don't fully appreciate is that for some of these roles... Like, the global competition is intense, and it's not like you're talking about niche roles for which we're not talking about 20,000 applicants. You know, we are talking about a long list of a dozen people that you think that you're really on your hit list. And then when you start thinking about, in an Australian context, what you can afford to pay them, right, which is really relevant when you're paying them in Aussie dollars and whatever else, you start moving down the list. And, you know, I think we talk in our own workplaces about employee value propositions. And that's how I think we have to think about this sometimes. It's what's the totality of what's on offer here? And it's the experience. It is the bit of the what's the stability that you're offering me? What's the optionality? And not everyone's chasing permanent residency, but a lot of them are coming with young families and want to know that if it actually works out and they love the company and there's a huge future for them in a dynamic, growing, competitive Australian business, you know, you'd like to know that it's a possibility. And to close the door on that, I think, is a real issue for Australia. And I think, you know, when you're thinking about wanting to attract the best and brightest, to not be able to have all the things that you can offer on the table is, quite frankly, naive. I think, you know, whether they stay or not, whether they stay and then move and come back or whatever, you know, we want to be doing everything we can. We're talking about really skilled people, and you want to do everything you can to get them to come here and bring their skills, build workforces, and, you know, even if they go, leave a bit, and if they want to stay, they've proven their worth. Why wouldn't you try before you buy?
Thanks, Jigal. My question is for Kian, actually, on that issue, and maybe if you could expand. You guys are gigantic. I mean, you're formerly the merged body of HP and CSC. You employ over 100,000 people globally. On this particular issue that we just touched on here, and you can share with us, how's our reputation? Like, when you're looking across the DXC world, are we losing out people because of how good are we at this?
Look, I mean, we're still a very attractive proposition. I think, you know, people will not always look to Australia because they're going to come and work with the evolving technology. It's more probably a lifestyle option for people, or the ability to take the skills that they've honed and actually apply them to industry in Australia and actually be the ones to stamp their name on what they've done. So I wouldn't say that we're missing out, but in recent time, I've had a number of occasions, certainly last year, where there was a real lack of pace around how quickly we could get people into roles, which ultimately meant that we then had to acquire people from other parts of the world, which meant we missed out on probably the premier people for one reason or another, and the transparency was the issue, because we just could not get visibility to the reasons why. And they came through a month or 2 months later, but, you know, by that stage, we'd missed out the person who really would have actually managed to transform that business. And it impacts our clients too. So Australian business really is looking for the best and brightest to come over here and actually help transform their businesses. So I wouldn't say we're missing out, but I think, the battle for skill at the moment is a global one. So, you know, if you're really good at what you do, there is a host of countries out there and you can pretty much apply your business anywhere you want to go. So whilst we're beautiful, you know, there's beautiful places out there that will take people quicker. So we just need to make sure that we evolve to a point where we are fast. And we, you know, from a technology standpoint, absolutely need to make sure that we're fast.
Question here and then there, if you wouldn't mind to go.
Thank you. Caroline from St Lane's Clark and Associates. There's been a lot of conversation about community concern about people coming into Australia under the skilled migration or migration. Do we have data about the number of skills that we are losing from our own Australian talent?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Because we have information about and community concern about what's coming in.
Yeah.
Which community shouldn't be concerned at all. But no one's talking about having that conversation about the talent that we lose to other global companies and organisations, because it's a revolving door.
Mm. I'm going to just, Henry, I'm going to put you on notice. Do you have any, you don't know? I don't have a contemporary number. I know a while ago, thinking about I've heard it remarked about in the context of the diaspora, and, you know, over a million Australians overseas, and for not just on holidays, but resident overseas, and, you know, quite high skilled. You know, people with good qualifications, usually university qualified, who've chosen to pursue opportunities overseas. It's really interesting because I think, you know, we're talking about the barriers to people coming here. Obviously, we want also to retain skills, but I think there's sort of a broader mentality or issue here from my perspective, which is, you know, having Australians go and work overseas, and a lot of them end up returning when they're at the age when they want to have family and all the rest of it. And so bringing that expertise back is actually a really good thing. And it's not just the expertise, but I think one of the other things that's been a real focus is how do we use those connections and leverage those connections better? And it's, you know, while they're there, but also the relationships that they build. And I think those networks, and that's, you know, to go to the point we were just having before about permanent. If that's an option that people want and they come here, great. If they don't stay and they go, they've still, you know, to be a bit cliche, they still kind of take a bit of Australia with them, and they've still have that connection back to the time they've spent here. And I just think we, you know, when we think about skills, they are more mobile. We just need to have this framework and set up our system so that we facilitate that, which isn't to diminish the importance of integrity of the system and making sure that people have the right skills and, you know, have the and don't pass all the security tests and everything else, but that mindset about mobility and attractiveness is sometimes the piece that I think gets lost. And when you look at the sort of what I call the revolving door of reviews, you go and look at how the terms of reference are set. You go and look at how the consultation, if it happens, is framed. It's not framed in that way. It's just gets narrowly framed, and we don't take a step back and say, challenges, opportunities, you know, it's just very programmatic and process driven. And that's a bit of what we're trying to get out of this and talk about. There's examples of experience, you know.
So I've got one number, and it's recently I've been living in Singapore for 3 years. And so the Australian High Commission estimated between 25 and 30,000 Australians living and working in Singapore. shows you, you know, and they work, you know, for a few years, develop some really sort of, you know, as Singapore being that regional hub, amazing skills to bring back to Australia. And it just, I think just in terms of the debate, people forget about, you know, the large number of Australians going to other countries for under their temporary migration visa programs as well. And, you know, and
I thought you were going to say the T word then, Justin. You're going to say taxation.
No.
Well, that's a topic.
There are
for
some perks.
A topic for another day. A question over here.
G'day, my name's Alex from Startup Oz. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your third recommendation, the one that says the federal government should introduce a dedicated streamlined path for intra-company transfers of employees into Australia. I was wondering what the thinking behind that was, what you see the value or the issue that you're trying to solve with that.
To be honest, that's the most obvious red tape one for us. Ken, why don't you answer it?
Well, there's a few ways of looking at this, but you know, we as a global company trade off the fact that we are global. So what someone's doing in the UK is often very applicable to what we're doing in Australia. And in fact, they've got the blueprint, they've got the roadmap, and we really want these people to come across and show our clients what we're doing. Now, we can potentially offshore that and do it through another location, but it'd make it much easier if we brought these people onshore, and whilst they're doing it for us in Australia, they're doing cross-pollination of skills to resources in Australia, and that's very important to us. The other part is that we have a number of offshore locations that support Australian clients too. And it's important that we bring these people onshore for periods of time so they can culturally align themselves with our clients, so understand what our clients' businesses is, understand who the players are within that. So we use this continuously, and it's actually a part of what actually makes our company successful is that intercompany transfer.
So let me give you another example I was talking about before about, you know, if you look at the Hayne Royal Commission and this huge focus on certain parts of the governance and business regulation and all the rest of it, you know, most of the professional services firms would be thinking about how they're sucking people in at the moment from the rest of the world. There's a huge business opportunity, but potentially for them, if they're thinking about their workforce, there's a huge opportunity for how they develop and grow their own people, because you've got some people from other jurisdictions that might come over here, learn a bit about Australia and another regulatory framework, but also impart knowledge and skills from a different regulatory framework. They might be more junior, but there's such a demand for people at the moment, they've got this great step-up opportunity. And so as you're thinking about how you grow and develop your talent, they're the opportunities you're looking for. And again, I mean, it's the likelihood that there is someone sitting here in Australia that, or plenty, because the demand is so huge at the moment. It just seems of a low probability, and it's exactly the sort of thing that if you think about, is that skills list updating and reflecting that? Probably not. How do we think about that? And for these big companies, that's how they manage their workforce. How do you give people the opportunities that the that will crop up in one place at one time? And to make that difficult just seems, there seems to be no purpose in it. It's just a cost for no benefit, essentially. There was another question.
Yeah, hi, Ryan Fox from the New South Wales Department of Planning. So we're responsible for the New South Wales population projections over about 20 years, and we break them up into different zones, whether it's local councils or whatever. And so they feed into a bunch of important things, whether it's where to build schools or hospitals or transport infrastructure. And so what we're quite concerned about is we don't really have a good feel for where temporary migrants are spatially. So, yep. I mean, you know, obviously they're in the four big capital cities. They're probably near universities, that sort of thing. But do you know of any sort of other fine-grained detail, any anecdotes, any sort of lines we can go down to sort of bed it down a bit more?
You can share information with Gabby about data. Gabby, you're itching to answer this.
Sorry, it's the ACT ID data set that's come out from the ABS, and they contain small level area measures, but there are some issues obviously going down into that level. But it might be worth taking a look at that.
Well, the data is clearly a challenge. I mean, I think it's clear that most of the migration is ending up as to set along the eastern seaboard and Perth. But it is a challenge. Certainly, Melinda mentioned previously the Migrant Workers Task Force, which until the recent ministerial changes sat within my area, and that was one of the key challenges there. With obviously the skilled migration, the sponsored migration is relatively small. That's easy to trace because you've got an employer who's identified. But those other categories of people on student visas and working holiday makers, there just really isn't data about whether they are working, where they're working, who they're working for, and that presents a range of challenges on a range of policy fronts, including yours, obviously.
And it's a really interesting challenge, I think, and particularly from the workforce perspective. I'm actually just going to quickly flick to a question to Ian about this. How important? So I think one of the interesting sort of anecdotes or kind of facts that sort of sits out in the community is just the concerns is around the number of students who are coming in and taking jobs, and they're lower skilled jobs, and anyone you talk to will have their story about someone working at a 7-Eleven and why is that an Australian job, number of Uber drivers, all these sorts of things that we've all heard. How important is it to the students that you're attracting to be able to work? And what's, the sort of figure that I've got in my head is, 50% from work that we've seen. Does that sort of resonate? I mean, is this what students are juggling, and how important is it?
I think 50-50 is about right, and it applies as equally to domestic students as it does to international students. In fact, more of our local students would be working than of our international students.
Yeah.
In terms of how important it is to attract when students are making a decision about whether to come to Australia or whether to go somewhere else, it is very important.
Mm.
And it varies from country to country. So in many countries that are economically less developed, the capacity to work while you're studying is crucial, because they really, many of them don't have enough to support themselves when they come. From the more developed source countries, it's more important about the ability to work post-graduation.
Yeah.
So it's quite nuanced, but Australia has benefited from probably the most favourable work environment for international students over the last 10 to 15 years of any of the key competitors. So it's something that the government has supported the sector in quite well.
Mm. A question?
Hi, Joseph Manalo from Commonwealth Treasury. I've got a question for Ian. So you mentioned the revenue implications of changing the skill list with regards to accounting. So I've recently finished a postgraduate coursework degree at a Group of Eight university. I can definitely see that. But I was wondering, implicit in that comment was that you don't see much substitution towards other degrees if accounting was taken off the skill list. I was wondering if you could provide a bit more insight as to why you think there's so much preference for accounting degrees.
Yeah, well, that's not what I meant to say, because I think, in fact, what it's this continuation of having accounting on there year after year after year has made universities quite lazy about the range of offerings we do offer at that postgraduate business school area. And certainly we're finding that students, and you'll see the trends in the last several years, as the number of students coming to do accounting is falling, as the number of points required to get PR through that pathway is increasing. But finance, business analytics, all the big data side of business and stuff are becoming much more attractive to students. And the desire of students to remain in Australia, particularly Chinese students, who in the Group of Eight are 60 or 70% of the entire student body, is much less, as those opportunities to earn much better salaries and back in Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou and Shenzhen. So that equation's changing. So from places like China, the capacity to migrate to Australia is relatively unimportant. Only 2% of the people who were granted citizenship in the last 12 months came from China, whereas from India there was over 20% of the citizens were from India. And from India, that's a very important driver. So it's very much market by market. And then you have the secondary issue is the product that the universities are offering. And that it's been a very simple thing for universities to rely on that professional accounting product, which is basically driven by migration rather than by any great educational value. But we're being forced to move to offer a range of different products in that space. Does that answer the question?
A little.
Of course, there's been no course switching because accountancy is so attractive. So, I mean, if you can't do you just have to do accountancy, don't you?
Well, finance profession has been on there the whole time as well, and that's the second most popular of the business one. So it does drive popularity of the courses.
I'm going to open this up a little bit more broadly. We've talked a lot about temporary skills. We've talked about a little bit already about regional. But I want to come back to regional because in my comments I said now if it's not Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, it's regional. And there's been a lot of talk in the broader population debate around, migration, okay, but we need to get people out of Melbourne and Sydney, essentially, which is still where a lot of the jobs growth is and still where a lot of the high-skilled jobs growth is. So I'm just interested in everyone's perspectives, either from are we thinking about regional universities and we think about regional businesses, would you ever look to locate, are businesses talking about locating out of these areas to assist them in getting, you know, skilled migration, because we've seen this big growth in these labour market agreements? And what do we think we need to get right if that is actually going to become a feature of Australia's immigration program in the future? And I'm looking to you, Peter, to maybe kick that conversation off.
Nice easy one to...
It is, well. Well, you talked about some of the, you know, some of the regional sort of case studies that we've seen already.
Yeah.
You know, is that something that is going to become... Do you think that's going to become more of a feature of our migration program? And if so, how are we going to get that working?
Well, I think that's certainly a model for kind of small towns that are, you know, really struggling to continue to exist. But obviously that's highly labour intensive and involved for them to be able to identify a community to bring people over and integrate them. It's always been a challenge, I think, to... there's been for quite some time a focus on trying to bring migrants in and into regional areas, but it can be difficult. In part because, you say, most of a lot of the jobs and economic activity are in the major capital cities. So, you know, you can bring people in on specific visas. The Prime Minister announced a new regional visa earlier this year that would. But sometimes the issue then is the longevity of how long people stay in those regional areas. So people may come on a particular visa that requires them to stay in a region for a period, but once that period has passed. I mean, there are opportunities with technology and others, you say, for companies to potentially locate themselves outside in regional areas, and that's something we'd always like to continue to see. But certainly haven't seen any sort of strong sense of that occurring as yet.
Well, Ken, I'm going to segue to you there, because I think that's I've had some conversations with people around what they thought might happen with technology, in that, yes, you could get people working outside of the CBDs, there would be all sorts of advantages. And in fact, it seems that that trend is now almost done a 180.
It's true.
And
it's
people are now coming back to the CBD and back to getting people in the workplace rather than working from home.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big push to decentralise. We were closing down office floors because we were saying, you know, work from home policy. And we found that productivity was dipping a bit. So, you know, we have gone back to that sort of centralised model of getting people into the office. That said, I mean, we have created our best call centre globally is in Tasmania. In Hobart, and that was a conscious decision by us to invest in TAFE Tasmania in building that sort of supply network. And we have, by a country mile, no pun intended, the best service out of Tasmania, so much so that a lot of our global clients that traditionally have gone to India and other places because of cost are now going to Tasmania. Now, I don't think Adelaide is rural as such, but again, that's an area that we've done a lot of investment and built our large regional delivery centre out of South Australia. Part of that was originally a strategy that we had a while ago, but then when the car industry took a dive, we actually made a conscious decision to do transition of a number of people coming out of Holden at that stage. And that's probably a large investment for us as in South Australia at the moment too. Longer term, you know, could it be Orange? Could it be Parks? You know, could it be... I think the biggest challenge we'll face is where we can actually get the people with the right level of skills to actually locate themselves. Mm. And there will be people who may make lifestyle choices. I mean, we still have an office in Wollongong and an office in Newcastle, and it's not because we want to keep that office space, it's because we've got very skilled people who choose to live there. So it is a consideration for our industry, absolutely.
Justin, what do you think about
that? Yeah, look, I might just make a few comments about Western Australia, so where I'm based, which is an interesting time. I mean, look, it has a state that has the highest unemployment rate at the moment. But the predictions are that WA is now entering an upward phase in terms of the resources cycle, which that they don't expect any sort of repeat of the boom. But they are calling it a mini boom in terms of the resource projects now on the radar. And it just reflects the report indicating that the cyclical nature of skills and some of these resource projects in terms of construction phase require a lot of labour in regional areas of Australia, and just the cyclical nature of the resources industry. We recently did some work in terms of looking how prepared Western Australia is for the next upward sort of cycle of activity. And we looked at enrolments in the WA School of Mines in terms of mining engineers. Yeah. And you know, after the mining bust, enrolments dropped 80%. So for the last 5-6 years, only 20% of the mining engineers have been trained of what were trained previously. And so that underinvestment in terms of training of mining engineers now is going to be critical as the upward cycle of activity starts and so we're back to a stage where you are going to be needing the temporary skilled visa programs to be able to provide the labour that's needed. So look, interesting sort of dynamics. I think that's just a point as well in terms of how occupation lists are developed. You know, they're done on sort of a national level where the economy doesn't really kind of operate exactly on a national sort of level where skills are kind of equally sort of distributed. That's just sort of a comment as well, I suppose, in terms of, kind of honing into particular regions and where the skills required are. And if we're sort of then having to rely on temporary skilled visa programs that are designed on a national basis, it can get into very difficult territory.
Yeah. Ian, it's interesting, this point about, people coming in to study these courses. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing, the resources cycle, isn't it, that, wages go up and demand for particular types of skills go up. It becomes very attractive and people are sort of thinking about what's my career, look at it and think, well, I wouldn't mind earning $120,000 in my first job out of uni. But then you get this whipsaw sort of effect there. How do unis deal with that?
Not very well. Yeah. I was at my last university was UWA, and we were losing students halfway through their engineering degrees because they were being offered $150,000 a year to go and be a fitter and turner on a mine site or something. The universe, it's not within the control of a university in a great extent because we're subject to the supply and demand factors out there in the market. But universities are very poor at turning courses off. So we will keep those courses that were in demand during the boom for several years, well after there's anybody who actually wants to do them. And they still cost us just as much to run when there's only 8 students enrolled as they cost when there's hundreds of students, a little bit different. But so we're not agile and flexible in the way that a company like Chance Company can be in those sort of spaces. It takes 2 or 3 years from the time you start thinking about, I'd like to set up a new degree in undersea processing of offshore oil and gas or something, before you can even bring your first student in. And then it takes you 5 years to teach out the last student that enrolled after you decide to close it. So we're very we're very not agile.
And one of the things that's happening too, I was interested, Justin, you might have some conversations. We tend to think about resources as resources, right? But the way resources companies are doing things now is the pace of change and the adoption of new technologies is phenomenal. So it's not like you've got an iron ore boom and the way you're doing things is the same. I mean, the skill sets and the technologies change very rapidly. How are businesses responding in terms of their skill needs, and how are universities responding to that?
So the first point I'd make is when demand goes through the roof in a particular profession, we suffer in that we cannot attract people to teach.
Yeah.
Because you have to pay a huge amount. Even now, to get people to teach into business schools at universities, you have to pay significantly over the odds for what you pay for other academics. But when you're in a university like UWA or Curtin, and in the middle of a mining boom, you're paying your engineering staff huge. Just otherwise, they can just go off. And so there's a significant impact from that.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I think implicit in this idea that we're stealing temporary skilled migrants steal work is the fact that the labour market doesn't adjust.
No.
And there's just lots of examples kind of sitting in between in the comments you've just made that actually show, you know, people do respond to the signals internally as well as externally.
It's just been some interesting developments in Western Australia. Look, and I suppose it's during the mining boom, the sharp increase in wages because having to attract large numbers of highly skilled people, and just how the resource companies have dealt with that with the downturn through sort of utilising automation and sort of advanced technologies, and so now to the stage where there's now fully automated mines. Literally, there is no one. There is no one, or there's an operator from Perth that's controlling trucks. So it's quite a success story in terms of that innovation.
The other thing that happened in West Australia, of course, is as they had this boom, they couldn't get enough nurses and teachers and all the other, and so they ended up having to pay significantly higher wages to attract those core professions, and they're stuck with those higher wages now. So they pay their teachers and their nurses more in Perth, even though they're in a recession.
Yeah.
And how you can adjust as a state government those things, I really don't know.
Are there any other questions from the floor? Sorry.
Hey, my name is Devang Taylor. I'm from New South Wales Treasury. A lot of the earlier discussion focused on the challenges with the temporary skilled migration program and the lack of an incentive to permanent residency to get the people you want and the highly skilled people. Doesn't the permanent residency program address this? We have a skilled stream for that, which is both sponsored and independent. Why isn't that offsetting the problems in the temporary migration program?
So if I get the question, so it's basically saying that, you know, with the permanent program, surely that should attract enough to offset the short term. So look, I mean, absolutely. But the challenge we face, and I think we've alluded to a few times, is people are now in a position where, certainly within the technology base that we're working, that they're chasing the technology opportunity. So it's no longer a fixed country lifestyle choice. They're literally chasing a boom at the moment. It's a global boom. So, you know, they look at countries for a period of time. The attraction is the project rather than the long-term opportunity. I think certainly in certain areas, maybe in some of our sort of more senior executive areas, maybe we'll find individuals who make lifestyle choices to come to Australia. But where we're struggling at the moment is really that bleeding edge technology where we're trying to attract people for short periods of time to provide specific outcomes, and then they will look for the next outcome that may likely not be in Australia.
So what I thought your problem was is that you couldn't offer a permanent outcome at the end of that short 4-year.
No, it's just simply the case of getting people across fulfill.
But I think the point is that not for all of them. So I think in the tech sector, you've got, I mean, this is just a war for talent everywhere. But for some, and even for some in the tech sector, there is still an element of it's try before you buy on both sides.
Yep.
You know, people are looking for where are the opportunities and as I said earlier, I use the word optionality. I think that's a sort of reasonable way to put it, don't you think, Justin? Is that, you know, you may not ever want to use it, but you might. And if you're, you know, in your early 30s and you've got a young family and you're thinking about whatever, you know, where might we call home, to have that pipeline for which 55% we're using, and then to say no, it changes the whole nature of it. And I think the feedback from business is that it's changed the attractiveness of that visa class for some people that they're trying to attract.
And that's true. I'm sorry. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think the length of time where you can retain people, certainly even if they do not choose that, maybe that they will go off and do something different, but the opportunity of obviously staying for long enough to get an option in the future of staying in Australia, switching that off's a challenge too. And because, you know, we have then got longevity of up to 4 years of people, whereas if they can't see that, then 2 years, 1 year, you know, and then they'll go and do the next thing. So that certainly wasn't a retention mechanism.
Well, thank you everyone for your fantastic questions. It's my great pleasure now to introduce Teresa Liu, who's going to give us all a vote of thanks. Thank you.